Chemerinsky.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Erwin Chemerinsky, and I represent the plaintiffs Valerie Plame Wilson and Joseph Wilson. I'd like to request 2 minutes for rebuttal. This case poses an issue that neither the Supreme Court nor this court has ever addressed. Can a statute that does not apply preclude a constitutional claim under Bivens? I think that it's easiest to see the error of the district court by focusing on the specific claims in the complaint. The first count in the amended complaint, on page 32 of the joint appendix, is by Joseph Wilson for retaliation against him for his speech in violation of the First Amendment. The district court gave two reasons for dismissing this and all of the constitutional claims. The first is the district court found that the Privacy Act was a special factor counseling hesitation. But the Privacy Act has nothing to do with retaliation concerning speech. In fact, it's not even conceivable that Joseph Wilson could even have a claim under the Privacy Act. If Joseph Wilson hits...
Does that necessarily preclude the possibility of it being a special factor in the consideration of whether or not a Bivens action can be applied?
Yes, Your Honor. If the statute doesn't apply, if there's no conceivable way in which Joseph Wilson could have a claim under the Privacy Act, then it can't be a special factor. Every case where the Supreme Court has found a statute to be a special factor always involved it applying and providing some remedy. In Schweiker versus Chalicki, the Social Security Act applied. In Bush versus Lucas, the Civil Service Act applied. The Privacy Act doesn't provide Joseph Wilson any remedy whatsoever. If Joseph Wilson had filed just the First Amendment claim, it's unthinkable that the Privacy Act would be the basis for dismissal. The second ground that the district court gave for dismissing the First Amendment claim and all of the constitutional claims was the danger of the release of confidential information. But there's no risk of that with regard to the First Amendment claim. This court has said that a retaliation claim under the First Amendment has two elements. First, it has to be that the plaintiff engaged in protected activity. There's no doubt that Joseph Wilson's op-ed in the New York Times, his statements in Meet the Press, will protect the activity of the First Amendment. And second, there has to be a retaliation sufficient to chill a person of ordinary firmness. You don't need to look, no court would have to look at any confidential information for that retaliation claim. Your Honors, at the very least, I think what I've shown is that the district court erred in dismissing the First Amendment claim on these two grounds, and that requires reversal and remand. Let me go to the next claim, which is counter two to that equal protection. Here, Valerie Plame Wilson contends that her rights under equal protection were denied because she was treated differently from others who were similarly situated. The Supreme Court in Village Willowbrook versus Olick said, there's two components of such a class of one equal protection claim. First, it has to be that the person claims that he or she was treated differently from others similarly situated. And second, there has to be no rational basis for the difference in treatment. Again, look at the two grounds that the district court gave for dismissing the claim. The first was based on the Privacy Act. Once more, the Privacy Act has nothing to do with equal protection. Also, it has to be noted that the Privacy Act doesn't apply to the offices of president and vice president. Once more, a statute that doesn't apply should not be found to preclude a constitutional claim.
I'm not sure still, counsel, why it is necessary that the statute apply in order for it to be a special factor. I grant you that the cases in which statutes have been held to be special factors involved at least some theory of application, not always very clearly. But they don't, any of them say that it has to be applicable in order to be defective.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. In Schweiker versus Chalicki, in Bush versus Lucas, and in Carlson versus Green, the court said that the statute has to provide, quote, an adequate remedy. If the statute provides no remedy because it doesn't apply, then it wouldn't be a special factor counseling hesitation. Your Honor, I think the easiest answer to your question. Let's go back to
the
Justice.
The statute absolutely said there is no remedy. It certainly would preclude a remedy.
Yes, Your Honor. Then I think there would be a constitutional issue. Because one thing
that
the Supreme
Court. It would be a different question.
It would be a different question entirely.
The same as saying that it can't be a special factor just because it doesn't provide a remedy in this case.
No, Your Honor, that would be a different question. Then there'd be the question of, could Congress completely preclude a Bivens action if it provided no remedy? That would go to the question of, is Bivens constitutionally required, which neither the Supreme Court nor this Court has addressed. But this case doesn't require that you get to that constitutional issue.
We'd rather not.
And I think the easiest way of understanding the my position is to go back to Justice Harlan's opinion from Bivens, where the reason he said that there's a constitutional claim for money damages is that for a person in Bivens' shoes, it's money damages or nothing, unless there is a need for a remedy. For Valerie Plame Wilson and Joseph Wilson, it's money damages or nothing. And statutes that have no application shouldn't be seen as precluding Bivens. It's not even any indication that Congress meant these statutes to preclude claims for free speech, or equal protection, or deprivation of property without due process. At most, and now I can get to the last of the constitutional claims, invasion of privacy, there could be an argument that the Privacy Act might preclude a claim with regard to invasion of privacy if it was seen as a comprehensive remedial scheme. But here, too, I'd emphasize that the Privacy Act doesn't apply to the president or vice president. Now, if there's some indication that Congress here wanted to preclude a damage action, then we get to Chief Judge Santel's question. But the fact that Congress didn't want to apply the record-keeping requirements of the Privacy Act to the president and the vice president doesn't suggest that they wanted to immunize the president and the vice president from civil actions for money damages for invasion of privacy.
We don't have to decide immunity, though, do we, at this point?
Not at all, Your Honor. The district court did not decide the immunity question that had been raised by the defendant. The sole ground that the district court gave for dismissing the constitutional claims was finding two special factors counseling hesitation, the Privacy Act and the danger of the release of confidential information. And as to the latter, as to even the other claims beyond the First Amendment, it's completely speculative at this point as if there's any risk of revealing confidential information. There's already a criminal trial concerning the underlying facts of this case. It's our belief that the civil action can likely be entirely resolved based on those facts. But if it turns out that there are confidential facts that might be revealed, the district court can decide what's the appropriate course, and maybe one of the claims would need to be dismissed. As I said already, it's clear the First Amendment claim wouldn't require any disclosure of confidential information. The district court said the equal protection claim might, but even that's hard to see. Unless the government wants to say that some other agent was treated the same way as Valerie Plame, and they've never asserted that.
She would first have to show other agents treated differently.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how you can say there wouldn't be a danger of release of classified information. Now, that may not be enough. I'm not asking you to concede your case, but
now,
you referred to the criminal case. There was an awful lot of classified brought into the courthouse on the criminal case.
My point is, at this stage, it's speculative as to whether confidential information would need to be revealed. I think it's clear as to the First Amendment claim it would not. But even as to equal protection, the appropriate course is to go forward and see. And then maybe the equal protection claim will need to be dismissed. But it's premature at this stage. I'd like to reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal.
Let me ask you something. You
of course.
In your given Bivens recitation before Wilkie versus Robbins, which was last year, in which what do you do about the language that hints at even, doesn't hint at it, it says, but even in the absence of an alternative, meaning an alternative remedy, a Bivens remedy is a subject of judgment, and then goes on. I mean, why isn't that a hint, a very broad hint, that there doesn't have to be an alternative remedy?
Well, 2 points. First, if you look at 127 at page 2600, the Supreme Court expressly said, with regard to Wilkie Robbins, there was an adequate administrative remedy.
Okay.
Second, Your Honor, if there were no remedy at all because the statute applied but didn't provide one, then I think Wilkie versus Robbins would be appropriate. But this is a different situation. This is a situation where the statute doesn't apply at all. It's not like when you had, say, the Civil Service Reform Act, but it doesn't provide a remedy to a particular plaintiff. Here, the statute doesn't apply to the president and vice president. The statute doesn't provide any remedy for First Amendment violations. The statute doesn't provide any remedy for equal protection violations. Very different than Wilkie versus Robbins.
In other words, there's an absence of an alternative. Why doesn't that language fit this case?
I think what absence of alternative means is that there's a statute that applies, but it doesn't provide a remedy in that instance. That's Bush versus Lucas, Schweiker versus Strzelecki. This is an instance where there's not a statute at all. Joseph Wilson could not sue under the Privacy Act. I would be shocked if the attorney for the government would say that Joseph Wilson could have possibly brought a claim under the Privacy Act for his First Amendment claim. It's not an adequate alternative. The statute is inapplicable. And, Your Honor, if it would then be the situation where there's truly no remedy, statutory or administrative, for a constitutional violation, because a statute was deemed to preclude it, then you would get to the constitutional issue of can Congress foreclose all Bivens actions.
What do you do with the district court's suggestion that there were potential Privacy Act claims available to the plaintiffs here?
Well, again, I think you have to break this down claim by claim. As to Joseph Wilson's First Amendment claim, there is no Privacy Act claim there possible. He doesn't have any possible ability to bring a Privacy Act claim. I would say with regard to the equal protection claim and with regard to the claim for deprivation of property without due process, the Privacy Act wouldn't apply. The one place where the Privacy Act might apply is with regard to the invasion of privacy claim, but here the Privacy Act does not apply to the president or vice president because the Supreme Court's decision, Kissinger versus Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. So we're back to what I started with, a statute that doesn't apply. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal. Hear from the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Jeffrey Buchholz from the Department of Justice. Excuse me. I'll start, if it pleases the court, with the question of whether the Privacy Act provides no remedy, doesn't apply, however you want to characterize it whatsoever here, and whether that bars its application as a special factor. That's wrong factually, and it's wrong legally.
Could I just mention, what do you do with our decision in Sussman, at least as to Mr. Wilson?
With your decision, and I'm sorry, I didn't hear, Your Honor,
in
which case?
Sussman decided July of 2007 that said only the only person who can bring a cause of action under the Privacy Act is the person whose records are at stake. Now, Mr. Wilson's records aren't at issue here.
Your Honor, the plaintiffs haven't cited that case, and I have to confess I'm not familiar with it offhand.
No, I know cited it, but it was decided by this court in July of last year, so we're bound by it.
I think.
How about as to Mrs. Wilson? Why don't you just proceed on that?
I think the way that I would suggest the court should look at the special factors issue is it doesn't depend on every claim. It doesn't depend on every legal theory. In Malesko, most specifically, the court said, so long as there is some avenue of redress, bedrock principles of separation of powers foreclose the creation of a non-statutory damages action. So the question isn't, can the plaintiffs get every item of damage, bring every theory, bring every type of claim they'd like to bring? The question under Malesko, even that one statement, is there some avenue of redress? But as Judge Henderson asked about Wilkie, the question isn't even dependent on whether there is some avenue of redress.
But
not
in
just
Wilkie, the court said he had avenues to be heard. All right, that was clear, and the courts said in response to the separate opinion that the rationale of its judgment in denying the Bivens action was that the standard was elusive. Now, that's not our situation here.
Well, I think Your Honor is correct. There are two steps to the analysis under Wilkie. Looking at step one only for the moment, and I'll turn to step two in a moment if I may, but at step one, the question is there some alternative process for protecting the interest? That's the way Wilkie put it. Mm-hmm. And it is simply not the law, and has not been, at least since Schweiker against Chalicki, as this court recognized in Spagnola, that there has to be some claim. There has to be some avenue of redress for the plaintiff. And I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Avenue of redress or other exist as to Mr. Wilson here?
I think when the district court asked at the oral argument whether all of the, because the plaintiffs were making the same argument that even if the Privacy Act is a special factor as to some of their claims, it's not as to all of their claims. The district court said, but all of your claims arise out of the same conduct. And Mr. Chemerinsky said, that's correct. So the district court properly declined to go claim by claim, legal theory by legal theory.
I'm asking you plaintiff by plaintiff at this point. There is a difference here in what the claims of the husband and wife are.
I think that the damages would be the same, Your Honor. According to the plaintiffs, the damages would be the same. And so that gets back into the same question of, is there some remedy, even to some extent, even if not to a full extent? And in Spagnuolo, this court, before Stryker against Schillicki, this court had divided on the question of whether the special factors analysis is supposed to go case by case, where you look at the actual plaintiff, you look at whether that plaintiff actually has a remedy under a statutory scheme.
Counsel, let me ask you, what is your understanding of the standard that this court has to apply in order to determine that Congress was not inadvertent in not providing a remedy here, where it excluded the president, the office of the president, the office of the vice president,
I think,
from coverage under the act? The district court just says that, but where is the indication of congressional intent here?
There are two answers I'd like to give to that question. The first is, in Spagnuolo, this court said that it is not true that in the CSRA there was any affirmative indication of an intent to bar Bivens' actions. But this court said that's not the right question. The burden
is
on Congress. This court said in Spagnuolo the right question is there an affirmative indication of an intent to preserve Bivens' actions alongside the statutory remedies? Where there is a comprehensive statutory scheme, the normal inference under Spagnuolo is Congress has created the remedies that it wanted to create.
Right,
it has drawn the lines.
Scheme cases, as counsel for appellants suggested, are cases where Congress said we're thinking about these types of plaintiffs, and we've decided we are going to provide the following remedies. Now, if the plaintiffs can't get all of the remedies they want, that's a problem that Bivens can't solve, all right? Because Congress has contemplated this situation and decided here are the remedies. Now here, what is the indication that we have to find that Congress had some contemplation that the Privacy Act, talking about agency records that are not maintained by either the president or the vice president's office, that this act was designed to preclude any constitutional claims that have nothing to do with records maintained by the office of the president or the office of the vice president?
Two answers, Your Honor. The first is the factual premise is not accurate, and I'll try to explain that in a moment. But legally, in Spagnuolo, this court expressly rejected the notion that Congress has to take the burden of specifying that it wants to bar Bivens'
but
claim. The normal inference.
The court has to find some indication, does it not? Because these rights are out there, and
the
now
indication,
you're talking about Congress is taking away rights.
The indication is in the comprehensiveness of the statutory scheme. In Spagnuolo, the plaintiffs fell outside of the judicial remedies in the CSRA. One of them was an applicant for a job and, as such, didn't have a judicial remedy.
I'm not making myself clear. In Congress, in looking at the concerns that people had about agencies misusing records and disclosing records, and Congress says, we're going to pass a statute providing certain remedies and only certain remedies, what does this court have to be able to determine that Congress contemplated that even though there are no records involved at the White House and, well, in the office of the president and the office of the vice president that we're talking about here, nevertheless, in passing the Privacy Act, it intended to take away Bivens?
I think that Your Honor doesn't have to address that question in this case because, again, the factual premise of the plaintiff's argument is not correct. The first disclosure, as the plaintiffs allege it, came from a State Department memo from a State Department employee. I don't know whether the plaintiffs could succeed in proving a Privacy Act violation there. They haven't tried to plead one. That's their choice. But it's simply not correct, and they even acknowledge this in their briefs, that the Privacy Act just doesn't apply to that. Of course the Privacy Act applies to that. Whether it provides a valid remedy to them or not depends on whether they can satisfy the standards Congress set out in the Privacy Act, just as in Spagnuolo.
I understand that the claim against Mr. Armitage, for example, say that's covered by the Privacy Act.
Right, but Your Honor, all of their damages come
but,
from
but
the same.
Can we say that Congress contemplated that a non-agency use of the records in the manner alleged in the amended complaint was contemplated by Congress? under the Privacy Act?
Your Honor, Congress contemplated whether to include the Office of the President and the Office of the Vice President in the Privacy Act, and it chose not to because it recognized that doing so would raise separation of powers concerns. So it's not accurate to suggest that it was somehow inadvertent that they got excluded from the Act. They got excluded from the Act on purpose. That means, under Spagnola and Chalicki, that the Privacy Act is a comprehensive scheme. It covers what Congress chose to cover. It doesn't cover what Congress chose not to cover. And the inference this Court should draw is, if the plaintiffs fall between the cracks, and again, this isn't even correct because the State Department is covered, but if plaintiffs were to fall between the cracks of the Privacy Act, it's because Congress designed the Privacy Act in a way that led them to fall between the cracks. And it's not this Court's job under Spagnola to sort of fill in those cracks and try to expand the remedies that Congress provided. Where Congress has given careful attention to a subject matter, as this Court recognized in Chung it did in the Privacy Act, Congress, the normal inference is it's Congress's job to create remedies, decide what standards to impose, who to give remedies to, what damages to provide for, et cetera.
In which case, decided by the Supreme Court, has the Supreme Court adopted your view of what is a comprehensive statutory remedy?
Well, I think in Chalicki, the Court, in Spagnola, this Court read Chalicki.
No, I want to know
as,
about the Supreme Court.
Okay, in Chalicki, but in Chalicki itself, the Supreme Court said that the Social Security Act was a comprehensive statutory scheme.
Yes, and because the nature of the disability there was contemplated by Congress.
And the disclosure of personal information by government officials was contemplated by Congress in the Privacy Act.
By the agencies.
Right, but Congress chose to define agency the way it chose to define it. It chose to exclude the President and the Vice President from that definition in order to avoid raising separation of powers problems. It would be doubly perverse for a court to create a non-statutory damages action and raise separation of powers problems that Congress chose not to raise in doing its job in creating a statute to decide what remedies to provide. All of this, though, Your Honor, is ultimately academic because the Privacy Act does cover the State Department. It does cover the first disclosure, the one that plaintiffs allege caused their damages. And so the Court doesn't have to address the hypothetical issue of what would happen if there was no statute that applied at all. And all of that also, in addition, Your Honor, is at step one of Wilkie.
Well, let me ask you, in Davis v. Passman then, where Congress had passed a comprehensive statute and it didn't apply to the congressman, and even though the Supreme Court said, you know, if you're going to allow suit by a former employee of a congressman, there are concerns. You have to be careful here. But the protections are provided through privileges. And that solves, as it were, the concern in terms of saying that the plaintiff had a Bivens action.
I think the Court can't look at Davis against Passman in isolation without looking at it in light of subsequent cases like Stanley and like Wilkie. If there was any notion
but
before Wilkie...
But none of those cases purport to overrule the analysis in Davis v. Passman?
No, not specifically. That isn't my point isn't that it has been specifically overruled. But if the Court looks at the way the Supreme Court has approached Bivens most recently, Wilkie specifically sets out a two-part analysis. Plaintiffs suggested that Wilkie was resolved under step one in saying that there was an adequate remedy. That's simply not the case. The Court looked at step one. It said step one was inconclusive. It said, therefore, this is a case for step two. And the Court resolved the issue against the Bivens plaintiff at step two. And it's important to focus on what types of problems the Court held were sufficient at step two to bar a Bivens claim. The Court, no one suggested in Wilkie that the Bivens claims would intrude on sensitive areas entrusted to another branch. No one suggested the Bivens claims there would be non-justiciable or anything close to that. The problems were much more prosaic. They were an order of magnitude less acute than that. The problems were it would be difficult to devise a workable cause of action. There would be line-drawing problems, that sort of thing. And the Supreme Court
said— Are you arguing that exists here?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Are you arguing that exists here?
I think what exists here is exactly what Judge Bates found, which is that it is easy to foresee that there are likely to be problems having to do with the sensitivity of the context of intelligence activities and operatives if this case were to go forward.
Well, I'm talking about we've had a lot of cases where the government has raised concerns about that, but that hasn't barred the cause of action itself. That's
where
a
Congress,
matter for the district court to address initially in discovery and on in addressing various privileges.
But under Bivens' doctrine, Your Honor, it is a question that goes to whether the claim should be recognized in the first place, under Stanley, under Sanchez-Espinosa, and under Wilkie. If Congress creates a statutory cause of action, then the court has to entertain that unless it's non-justiciable or there's some other reason why the court can't.
Wilkie doesn't step back from Bivens. It just deals with the situation it had. It said that the plaintiff there had avenues to be heard and that there was this elusive standard. That's the rationale of Wilkie.
What Wilkie does, Your Honor, is clarify that there is a separate step two, apart from whether or not there's a statutory scheme that could provide some redress. Whether or not there's a separate step two that looks at whether it makes sense to create the Bivens claim, whether the Bivens claim would be problematic or whether it's one that the court should have no hesitation about creating. That's a very low standard that's quite distinct from the strict standard of non-justiciability that would be necessary to refuse to entertain a claim that Congress had created. In Wilkie, the court said line-drawing problems are sufficient to bar a claim. In Sanchez-Espinosa, this court held—
But line-drawing problems in terms of defining the nature of the cause of action. That's not what we face here.
Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that the problems here are identical to the problems in Wilkie.
No, but you're talking about your step two analysis.
My point is that Wilkie made clear that the problems with the Bivens claim don't have to rise to a very high level of something like non-justiciability in order to militate against creating the claim. The problems here are not identical to the problems in Wilkie. The problems here are much more like the problems in Stanley and in Sanchez-Espinosa, where in Stanley the Supreme Court and in Sanchez-Espinosa this court said these Bivens claims would get the court into a sensitive area that is largely allocated to other branches under the Constitution. The courts should not jump in without a congressional invitation to sensitive areas and create a non-statutory damages action. What the court said in Sanchez-Espinosa about foreign affairs could equally be said about intelligence activities, and what the Supreme Court said in Stanley about military affairs, congressionally uninvited intrusion into military affairs is inappropriate, is equally true of intelligence affairs.
I'm just asking you, based on the amended complaint and the allegations there, and that's all we're to look at in terms of the Bivens question, aren't a lot of these issues to be resolved down the road?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think if you look at the complaint and what the damages the plaintiffs are seeking, their theory is that Mrs. Wilson couldn't do her job anymore. In order to, and not only couldn't do her particular job anymore, but was barred effectively from an entire sphere of work.
But I
and
understand,
also was put
but,
in.
But, you know, just as when the government comes before the court and raises a state secrets privilege claim, it doesn't necessarily mean the case can't go forward and that there's no cause of action. That's the distinction I'm trying to draw.
Your Honor, the state
you
secrets.
The government may have winning arguments on all of these points that you make, but doesn't that come after the question of whether or not
no, Your Honor,
have a
it doesn't.
Cause of action where the district court's holding is that a statute that doesn't even apply, at least to one of the plaintiffs here, is conclusive?
Your Honor, I disagree with that. I think Stanley is in contradiction to the approach that Your Honor just outlined. And Stanley, the Supreme Court, considered that what it should do is have courts consider on a case-by-case basis whether a given Bivens claim actually would intrude on military affairs, actually would cause separation of powers problems. The court said that's the wrong approach.
The distinction that you're making is that the state secrets doctrine comes into effect after the question whether there is a
cause of action. That's all
relief.
I'm getting at.
That's
and
correct,
in
Your Honor.
In the Bivens context, the question is whether the claim for relief exists at all.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. And under Stanley and under Sanchez-Espinosa and under Wilkie, it's clear that the court should consider that question, whether the Bivens claim should be recognized, by taking into account problems that recognizing the claim would be likely to create. Stanley expressly rejects the notion that the right approach is to recognize the claim in the first instance, let it proceed unless and until it actually creates the problems that the court is afraid of. Stanley says, no, that's not the right approach. The right approach is not to extend Bivens to the context at all if it's foreseeable that that context is going to be problematic. Thank you for Your Honor's indulgence. If you have no further questions.
If my colleagues have further questions, then we'll cede 3 minutes
Thank
to
you.
Mr. Chemerinsky, Dean Chemerinsky, for rebuttal.
Thank you. Contrary to Mr. Buchholz says, it is essential that this court look claim by claim and plaintiff by plaintiff, because if even one claim of the plaintiff's was improperly reversed by the district court, then you have to reverse and remand it back for further consideration. And I think to start with, the First Amendment claim was clearly improperly dismissed by the district court. The Privacy Act is inapplicable here. It has nothing to do with retaliation. As Judge Rogers said, there's no way that Mr. Wilson could possibly have sued under the Privacy Act. And as to the second consideration of the district court, there's no likelihood, no chance that it would lead to the release of confidential or secret information. All Mr. Wilson had to show was that his conduct was protected by the First Amendment, the speech, and that there was retaliation response. And his damages for this First Amendment claim very well might be very different from Ms. Plame's damages under the other claim. That's enough to justify reversal of the district court and remand. As to the other three constitutional claims, which focus on equal protection, deprivation of property without due process, and invasion of privacy, the key question is whether the Privacy Act is a special factor counseling hesitation and whether there is a danger of release of confidential information. Our position is, as to three of the defendants, Cheney, Rove, and Libby, the Privacy Act doesn't apply at all. Now, the government's position here is that Congress, by excluding the President and the Vice President of the Privacy Act, meant to preclude Bivens' actions. But there's no basis for that conclusion. We know that Congress didn't want to impose the record-keeping requirements of the Privacy Act on the President and Vice President. But there's not any indication in the statute or its legislative history that they therefore wanted to exempt the President and the Vice President from Bivens' actions.
Well, what about,
almost gets to a matter of burden assignment. This is not where Congress has created the cause of action you want to make here and excluded the President from it. This is where Congress has created a scheme as to which the government would now say there's something like a preemption doctrine. They took this field, and anything they left out of it is just not in the field anymore. They're not. They're saying you have a burden of showing Congress meant to leave the possibility of a Bivens Act. You're saying they have the burden of establishing Congress didn't mean to.
I think that's what Bivens would say here, and I don't think Spagnuolo is the contrary. Spagnuolo was a government employee, and the question was, is the exclusion of a remedy under the Civil Service Act for him preclusive of Bivens? This is a situation where the entire offices, the President and Vice President, were excluded. Now, at the end of the presentation, Mr. Buchholz was focusing on Wilkie, and this goes also to Judge Henderson's question. There are two steps to Wilkie. First is whether there's an adequate remedy. And the court did say in Wilkie that he had an adequate remedy. That's different than this case. But second, there's the balancing stage. And Mr. Buchholz leaves out of his description of Wilkie is just a Souter's majority opinion stressed that allowing the Bivens action in that instance would open the door to a floodgate of litigation. Recognizing a cause of action by Valerie Plame Wilson isn't going to open any floodgate of litigation.
My colleagues.
I have one question.
Sure.
Yeah.
In connection with the government's argument about special factors and the Privacy Act, how do you respond that that there was this concern about separation of powers, and that's what led to the exclusion of the offices, in addition to the concern about burdens of record keeping?
I think it's very important to be specific about what the separation of powers concern might have been. The separation of powers concern was that the record-keeping requirements of the Privacy Act, if imposed on the President and Vice President, would be quite onerous. That doesn't necessarily mean that Congress meant to say that any time the President and Vice President infringe someone's privacy, there can never be a claim for money damages. One doesn't follow from the other.
So as you read it, then, that was the nature of the separation powers concern.
I think clearly the reason Congress exempted the President and Vice President was so that the record-keeping requirements would not be there. I don't think there's any disagreement between the government and us about that. The question, it goes to Chief Judge Santel's issue of, can you infer from that exclusion a desire to preclude all Bivens actions? And here I'll just conclude where I started. There's no case by the Supreme Court or by this court that's ever dealt with a situation where a statute that doesn't apply at all to an agency was found to preclude a Bivens action. I think for a plaintiff, it's damages or nothing, and that's why there has to be a Bivens action here.
Thank you, counsel. Seeing no further questions, the case is submitted. Give us recess.
Stand, please. This honorable court now stands adjourned until the 11 o'clock.